The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Romany Arrowsmith from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Glamour Magazine, Rookie Magazine, and Lit Hub Magazine. The theme for today's program is balance. Balance in work, balance in life, balance in everything. And this first article from Literary Hub Magazine is on high school English, balancing the job with the calling. Before he entered a Trappist monastery in the woods of Kentucky, Thomas Merton taught freshman composition at Columbia in Harlem. He told students that they should stick to concrete and tangible evidence in their writing. One student responded by handing in descriptions of shoe factories that made you feel as if you were being buried under 50 tons of machinery. Merton learned, with wonder and fear, that teachers have a mysterious and deadly power of letting loose psychological forces in the minds of the young. The rapidity, the happy enthusiasm with which students often follow hints and suggestions, but with the wrong response, is enough to make teachers run away and live in the woods. I do head for the woods each day after teaching, to run on the trails, but I get Merton's point. You need a nearly monastic patience to teach high school English. Some days the classroom feels like a symphony, other days a threnody. Each day is a surprise. Like Merton, I've taught freshman composition, and know there's not a world of difference between those students and the high school seniors that I teach every day. English, or the humanities, the department name in my school, is the study of story, language, and communication. The study of us. I've been thinking about teaching and patience at the start of the new school year. And whenever I think of patience as it relates to the classroom, I'm drawn back to the idea of teaching as a vocation, a calling. A vocation need not be patently religious or spiritual, but there are elements of those worlds, the feeling that we are drawn to be something more than ourselves. I asked Tricia Ebarvia, an inspiring and talented teacher, what she thinks of teaching as a vocation. This is her 19th year teaching high school English. She's the department chairperson at Conestoga High School in Berwyn, Pennsylvania, located outside Philadelphia. She was a Heinemann Fellow from 2016 to 2018, where she wrote regularly about creating an inclusive literacy classroom. Her thoughts about teaching have appeared in the New York Times, English Journal, and Education Week. Ebarvia seemed like the perfect person to ask, since she's used the word vocation to talk about teaching. During the first week of each school year, she invites students to ask her questions on index cards. Inevitably, she recalls, a student asks what my dream job would be. It's an interesting question because it assumes that my dream job would be something other than teaching. She explains, but the truth is, I can't imagine doing anything else but teaching. I've always believed teaching to be a vocation, from the old French, a calling, and not just a job. What does it mean to consider teaching a vocation rather than a job? What is the difference between those identities in the day-to-day life of a high school English classroom? I'm conflicted on this, Ebarvia tells me. I do believe that there is nothing else I've been called to do but be an educator. It's where I think my talents and abilities can be best served toward the public good. I think this is what, for me, distinguishes a job from a vocation. She continues. That said, even if I consider teaching a vocation, it doesn't mean it's not a profession and that teachers shouldn't be treated as professionals. I worry that when we overemphasize teachers doing it for the kids, which is not what I necessarily mean by vocation, we expect teachers to be compensated in the satisfaction of doing what they love rather than true professional, monetary or otherwise, compensation. She's right. Teaching, done correctly, is a demanding, exhausting job. You've got to give a lot of yourself, emotionally, intellectually, for many kids each day. For most of us, that is about 125 different kids across our daily classes. English is such a dynamic subject that, in any given class period, we might examine poetry and fiction, pop culture and history, rhetoric and identity, not to mention little topics like life, death, and what it means to be alive. I think Ebarvia models what it means to be a teacher as professional and also as one drawn to it through vocation. She puts kids first, where they belong. Kids have stories to tell, she says. Our job is to be intentional about making the space in class. This means offering mentor texts and models for authentic storytelling, then giving students time in class to draft, workshop their writing with peers, and revise. Being a professional means recognizing what kids need beyond the texts we teach, perhaps nothing more than humility. Abarvia laments that often students don't have good models of humility for them in society. Given today's polarized times, students often see public figures and celebrities who model the exact opposite of humility, cultural and intellectual arrogance or ignorance. I think teachers can model humility by sharing their own stories of times they learned they were wrong. She told me about how, while teaching The Things They Carried, a friend sent her an article about the book that pointed out the ways in which the Vietnamese characters were objectified and exploited. I had never read the book through that lens, and I had just spent the last few weeks analyzing the book without that lens with my students. I felt terrible. I shared the essay with students, and the shame I felt, even as an Asian American, that I didn't consider that point of view, and the impact that it might have had on other readers. Because students often think that teachers are supposed to have the answers, I think it's important to show them that continual growth is critical, and that means admitting when your own learning is either incomplete or wrong. That's real humility and real professionalism. Abarvia concludes, I believe the work teachers do is some of the most critical work we can do. While they have yet to be a truly democratizing force, in fact, I'd argue that schools have done just as much to perpetuate and institutionalize societal inequities, I still believe that schools at their best can help change, not reflect, society. In other words, schools are not just about preparing kids for the world, but preparing them to change it for the better. That sounds like a good job to me. So that was by Nick Rapatrazone from Literary Hub magazine. This next article is from Glamour magazine and is about procrastination, which is definitely something I suffer from. The title of the article is The Simple Exercise That Showed Me How to Stop Procrastinating for Good by Samantha Leach. It's winter. Politics sucks, the weather sucks, and we're all sick of being inside. Our winteritis stories are for women who can't read another think piece, who've pushed the outer limits of time it's possible to spend on social media, and who kind of want to shop online and hibernate until spring is here. Okay, so it's not quite winter yet, but I thought since the weather was about to turn, this would be a good pick. Winter is the least productive season. There's even data to back it up. We get 5% less work done in winter than we do in fall, the season when we're most efficient. That is back to school season, after all. This might seem like a small difference, but it adds up. Then again, who can blame us? The sun sets earlier, stamina wanes, and Netflix beckons, given that procrastination runs rampant. While even experts admit the behavior is normal, it can still have adverse effects on our mental health. Research shows that procrastinators experience higher levels of stress than those who remain on task, and that sense of dread that sets in when you get trapped in an Instagram refresh loop, it can't be great for your nerves. In a recent report, researchers had their participants keep a journal to track tasks completed through the day and include information on when their attention wandered and what distracted them. The researchers found the entries helped illuminate how subjects could increase their productivity by showing them where and what caused them to get sidetracked. The idea inspired me to test out a similar protocol. For a week, I kept a record of how I procrastinated at work. It happens. Then I shared it with experts in the field for some advice. For a sense of what a procrastination journal even looks like, I've included a snippet of mine below. The exercise showed me I tend to procrastinate most in the morning because I have a hard time jumping into the day. I also learned that social media is my biggest trigger. Can I help that I love cute pictures of my favorite celebrity children? No. Can I manage not to stare at them for 22 minutes when I should be finishing an assignment? Okay, fine, yes. Here's a taste of what I mean. 10 a.m., I start off the day by giving myself 15 minutes to check Twitter. I tell myself it's to scan the news to see if there's anything I should be writing for Glamour, which is part of my job, but when the 15 minutes turns into 20, it's clear I'm just trying to put off my to-do list. 12 p.m. I finish the first half of my story and reward myself with an internet break. I've been obsessed with scoring a brunch reservation at the Blue Box Cafe for my sister's 21st birthday, but the restaurant is completely sold out. I refresh Resi a few times just in case something opens up, then I read an infatuation guide on best brunch spots to find a backup. Editor's note, I got the reservation, and the chicken salad finger sandwiches were worth all the effort. 1:55 p.m. I see in our work Slack channel that Kim Kardashian has posted new photos from her daughter's Chicago's first birthday on Instagram. I crumble. I have to see more of her Alice in Wonderland-themed party. I end up checking out the rest of my Instagram feed, which takes about 10 minutes. 3:30 p.m. I hit the afternoon slump and begin intermittently G-chatting as I get through my task list. It doesn't prevent me from working, but I'd be lying if I said it didn't slightly slow me down. I shared the full journal with Carleton University's Timothy A. Pitchell, Ph.D., author of Solving the Procrastination Puzzle, and Christine Lee, Ph.D., founder of The Procrastination Coach. Both told me that while this level of procrastination isn't the worst they've seen, there are simple skills I could learn to stop the bad behavior altogether. And after following their advice, I was able to pay better attention to the tasks at hand, which meant articles written faster, and for the first time ever, inbox zero. Below, Pitchell and Lee share their tried-and-true methods to drown out distractions and get work done, whether or not the polar vortex has iced out your attention span. 1. Turn off your notifications. Between the CNN alerts we get on our phones, the Slack messages we receive at all hours on our computers, and the countless new emails that hit our inbox every day, we're inundated with notifications. While it's important to be on top of communication, the incessant pings can slow your pace at work. You shouldn't have notifications active when you're working on other tasks, Pitchell says. We simply don't have that much willpower and self-control, so we shouldn't rely on it. We need to set up the environment to work in our favor, not against us. For the true radical, Pitchell recommends turning phones off or putting them far away from your workspace. I'm a cell phone junkie, which is why I've tried to force myself to test this out. Yesterday, I left my phone in my bag for over 2 hours, embarrassingly a record, and all I missed were a couple of texts from my mom that said things like, "How's your day, sweetie?" which is nice, but not urgent. 2. Don't toggle between assignments. How many tabs are open on your computer right now? Between email, that article you wanted to read, a presentation you're in the middle of preparing, and the Google Doc you're contributing to, there's so much going on your screen, it's hard to pay attention to just one task at a time. But if you're catching up on a few messages and only adding one paragraph at a time to that project, it can feel like you have so much to do, but you aren't making any progress. Focus on one task at a time. Train yourself to focus completely when you're doing your big work, and then save the smaller tasks for another block of time, says Lee. Commit to working with this type of single-minded focus by writing your plans down in a time block format where each task gets a particular block of time on your calendar, and don't switch between assignments for the entirety of that time period. Lee also recommends using a paper planner. The act of writing tasks down helps us feel more committed to doing them. I've always been loyal to the classic Moleskine, but lately I've been eyeing this one from Ashley Mary. She's got a link to, I'm sure, some kind of paper planner. 3, practice mindfulness. No matter how hard a worker you are, you're bound to hit a slump. Everybody's attention wanders at some point. What's most important is that you're able to bring your focus back to the task at hand. A practice that Pitchell has found helpful for strengthening this skill is mindfulness meditation. As soon as we sit to meditate, our minds wander. We think about everything and anything else, he says. But mindfulness meditation involves acknowledging that our minds have wandered, that we have thoughts and feelings, and then just bringing our attention back to the breath. This practice is a strong foundation for our everyday lives as we learn that our attention does wane, but that we can bring our attention back to where we want it to be. You can test it out for a few minutes on a lunch break or before you go to bed. If mindfulness isn't for you, Pitchell has a different suggestion. When you feel your attention wane, ask yourself a simple question. What's the next action I need to take? When we focus on that next action, a small, simple next step, we're no longer focused on our waning attention, and we often find that we can bring ourselves back to the task and action we need to do. You've heard of the to-do list. Maybe you keep a running account of everything you need to do on sticky notes on your laptop, or you write them out in your planner. But according to Lee, you shouldn't just chart out what you still have to get done. You should also keep track of what you've accomplished. It can be helpful to actually log what you've completed, she says. Writing down what you've already gotten done helps build a reinforcement system where your good efforts at work are positively reinforced. This can give you that extra oomph the next time you need to gear yourself up to get back to working on an assignment that's intimidating you. It's not unlike when you get a sticker each time you've completed a task in grade school. Having that positive reinforcement and a reminder that you're able to crush your work can help keep you motivated and stave off potential distractions. Remember, everyone falls into the procrastination trap. There's even research to prove it. All that matters is that at some point, you put down Instagram and refocus. Take it from someone who knows. KKW's latest post will still be there for the commute home. Okay, some useful tips about balancing your life and your work and not procrastinating. This next article is also from Glamour, but it's about a different kind of work-life balance. This is about the author of the book Wild, Cheryl Strayed, who is telling us her secret to finding love after loss. When I was 5 or 6, my parents got divorced. By the time I was a teenager, I realized that my parents' divorce was one of the most fortunate things that ever happened to me, because it allowed me to be free of a home where there was domestic violence and emotional abuse. But what I can tell you is that when my parents were getting divorced, I was so distraught and so sad. I experienced real grief and real heartbreak as a child. But the great big giant loss of my life is my mom's death. There are certain kinds of losses that are simply forever. The loss of my father is also in this category. You don't get to go back in time. You either have parents who were there for you and did a good job of living for you, or you didn't. And if you didn't, it is a loss that you have to reckon with for the rest of your life. I don't mean that it will always rule you or always be something that holds you back. In fact, it's the contrary. I think some of our biggest losses can actually be our greatest gifts because they teach us all about how to be strong and resilient, how to have compassion for others. They teach us that in life there can be beauty, even in the face of suffering and loss. Losing my mom is a loss that defined my life. It defined in so many ways what I would need to do to feel safe in the world, what I would need to do to feel loved in the world, how I would try to fill the gigantic hole she left in my life when she died. When my mom died, so much of that destructive stuff I did, using drugs or having promiscuous sex or any sort of reckless behavior, was so much about love, so much about trying to find love in this weird way, trying to show the world this woman's life meant so much that I'm going to ruin mine to honor her. So that's what was really going on for me in these wild years after she died. A really important thing that I just want to say out loud over and over again, a thing I know to be true in my own life and that I also know to be true in other people's lives, is that it never stops being a loss. It still is not okay that my mom is dead. It still makes me sad. I still feel her absence in my life. But it's a different kind of feeling. It's not like I'm in pain every day and I can't bear it. I also got married ridiculously young, way too young. I was a crazy young person who was just wildly in love. And very quickly after I married my first husband, I realized that while I did love him, I shouldn't be married to him. And so when my mom died, what happened is my grief was so tremendous that it was like everything in me just disintegrated and I couldn't pretend anymore. I couldn't hold that marriage together. I couldn't continue to stay inside of something that wasn't exactly what I wanted, and my marriage fell apart because of it. I really, really, really grieved the loss of my first marriage, even though I was the one who said, "I don't want to be married anymore. Let's end this." But it was a different kind of grief than the grief I had for my mom. I'll always grieve my mom. It'll be a loss that will always be a hard one for me. The loss of my first marriage was a temporary grief. It was a temporary loss. There shouldn't be this timeline for grief. I think pathologizing pain is something that our culture does quite well. You should be sad if somebody you love deeply dies. That's a normal response to a really sad, hard thing that happened. The first step to healing is to accept that sorrow is real and it's going to take some time for it to lift. And then once it does lift a bit, to accept that that's not a sign of your lack of love or commitment or dedication to that person, but that it's really that your loss is shifting into something a little deeper, where you're starting to say, "I realize that this thing is true. This is a fact. My dad isn't going to reappear like a magic genie and be there in my life again, ever again. Or my mom isn't." We have to carry it, to say that the person is gone forever, but at the same time will always be present, so that in the absence of the beloved, there is a profound presence that we can make manifest in our lives by the things we do and live and believe and say. I love my kids the same way my mother loved me, and perhaps that's the most powerful way I've carried her. I've carried that full throttle, wild abandon, imperfect, but without any question, it's their love that I got from my mom. and I give it to my kids and they carry it forward. They'll carry it onward. She's alive in them. She's alive in their spirits, even though they never met her. The power of vulnerability is also truly magic. Vulnerability, I've become convinced, is the way to get love. And of course, many of us decide not to be vulnerable because we're afraid. But vulnerability is the way to get love, romantic or otherwise. The minute you are the one who says, "I'm afraid right now," or "I'm missing my mom," or "I am in the midst of a divorce," the minute you simply say what's true, people open themselves up to you and they offer you consolation, an essential connection. I think that so much of loving well is about courage. It's about telling the truth as soon as possible, as often as you can. That's the secret to a good life, and that's about vulnerability. Vulnerability is simply telling the truth about who you are as often as you can in any given situation. And nobody said any of this was going to be easy. If you're looking for love again, there's just no way around the fact that you have to be vulnerable in order to connect with others. Nobody's going to love a cardboard box version of you. Nobody wants to feel like they're knocking at a closed door when they're in a relationship with you. We want the real, juicy, meaty you. We want the tender stuff on the inside. And so I think it's just about saying, suck it up and be brave. It really is. And a good way to practice doing it a good way to practice it is doing it every day, in every relationship, in every context. Say the true thing. That was an excellent essay about balancing grief and growth in your life. And this next one is about balancing your material things, about what to save and what to throw away. This one is from Rookie Magazine by Pixie Casey, and it's called Closet Graveyards. My best friend is a minimalist. Anything that can be thrown or given away should be, in his opinion. When a commercial for space bags comes on the television, he becomes visibly irritated at the sight of the smiling, vacuum-powered space savers on the screen. "Why don't people just get rid of stuff they don't need?" he always asks, and I always shrugged, acting as if I don't at least own 2 space bags and 3 plastic bins filled with old t-shirts and some well-dressed ceramic cows sitting in my closet. The closet is an intensely personal space. It's filled with pieces of who you are, who you were, and, as any tag still on dress might suggest, whom you'd like to be. It is the graveyard of former identities, a place that swallows old letters, books with broken spines, and shoes with worn-out heels. The plastic Harry Potter glasses you got at the midnight release of The Half-Blood Prince are crammed in a box with Blink-182's ticket stubs. Who's embarrassed? Not me. Half-finished diaries sit in old backpacks, and old backpacks carry messages of their own, covered in graffiti and sew-on patches. A closet is a museum of you, and in cleaning it, you effectively become its curator. Some people, like my best friend, are good at keeping their closets current. He barely owns anything that he doesn't use. He is the type of person who reads and enjoys a birthday card and then immediately tears it up and throws it away. The other end of the spectrum is hoarding, where the person is lost beneath the things they own. Most people, I imagine, fall somewhere in between, allowing their closets to be both functional and messy. Mine has always leaned more toward the latter, but not to the point where it requires a visit from an organizational guru and an A&E camera crew. When I sat down to write this essay, the main image in my mind was that of a wig in a white box, my mother's wig from the 60s. My sister and I had found it one morning while digging through my parents' closet. It was long. She had never had long hair, as long as I could remember, and looked very Penelope Tree, and we immediately made her try it on. "My wig," she said when we presented it to her, followed quickly by, "Where did you find this?" And then, "What were you doing in my closet?" I remember being fascinated with my mother's wig, mostly because it was a relic from her past, and finding it allowed my sister and me to imagine her in our minds, getting ready to go out pre-us with her Penelope Tree hair and thick eyeliner. It also struck me that, for whatever reason, she had kept the wig. Did she plan on wearing it again? Doubtful. Does she even remember it was there? She claimed not to. But there it was, anyway, waiting to be found. By contrast, we only found a few of my father's old things to wear, and most of them had been donated as soon as they went out of style. My mother, who did most of the donating. Who knew you'd want your father's old golf shirts? The who knew aspect has always stayed with me. As high school went on, I found things under my bed or in my closet that I hadn't paid much attention to, only to resurrect them as ironic fashion statements years later, like the plastic heart-shaped bangles that I'd worn in elementary school, an ALF pin, and an ill-fitting Reese's Pieces baseball hat. You never really know how an object will fit into your life somewhere down the road. My prom dresses, for example, have been sitting in my parents' storage room for about a decade now, all dressed up with nowhere to go. A few weeks ago, my 8-year-old niece opened the door and took a look. "You can have those someday if you want," I told her. "Will she actually take them?" "Maybe." "Will she pull a Molly Ringwald and pretty and pink them?" "A dreadful possibility." "Will she end up wearing it ironically to a 90s prom party in 7 or 8 years?" "Perhaps." The dresses, which had once seemed so important, had just become silly trinkets. It was her reaction to it that made it special. Who knew? I am terrible at getting rid of things. Every 6 months or so, I try to clean my shelves. I think about the important things, about my best friend's spare closets, about the organizational gurus on televisions who say things like, "Do you own this thing or does it own you?" I vacuum the floor and then empty my entire closet out onto it, making one giant mountain that I then attempt to separate into smaller peaks. Mount giveaway, mount save, mount maybe. Mount maybe always ends up being the biggest, which I guess is typical if you don't necessarily want to hang on or let go, but you're not quite sure how to fill the gap between the two or what to wear while you're falling into it. My first closet was a split. I had to share 50% of it with my sister, and we had a system for filling it up. Her clothes went on the left, mine on the right, just like our beds. The top shelf was devoted to things neither of us used anymore, but wanted to keep anyway. We ignored that top shelf for years. By the time we actually got our own rooms in high school, there was almost a decade of useless crap up there, covered in cobwebs and filled with corroded batteries. When we cleaned the shelf off, I recognized that most of the crap was mine. Souvenirs from school field trips, a jewelry box filled with forgotten trinkets and old storybook tapes, including a recording of Best Friends for Francis that we used to listen to obsessively. "Look at this," I remember saying about mostly everything. "Remember this?" The closet I took over remains as it was at my parents' house, holding the remnants of my former life. There are dried flower petals, letters from a handful of people, and notebooks filled with absolutely dreadful poetry. When I was younger, I came close to destroying all of it several times, but I couldn't bring myself to do it. At the time, it was probably because I was overly sentimental about the people who had written the letters and the events that had inspired the poems. If your room were somehow frozen in time and an anthropologist from the future took a tour of your closet, what would they make of you? My imaginary report would probably read something like this. Female, early 30s, shows an affinity for bold patterns, cardigans, wears her sneakers for approximately 6 months longer than she should. My best friend's question would echo in the subtext. Why did she keep all this stuff that she didn't need? And I'm sure most future researchers would give the obvious answer. Because she could. All right, and we've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Romani Arrowsmith, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.